This is Jim Fossone from VeteransRadio.net, broadcasting from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. We want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. Also, we'd like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. Until then, let's take it back to Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We are thrilled today on Veterans Radio to have as our guest Dr. Ronald Tesler from the Harvard Medical School. He's a professor of healthcare policy. Ron, Dr. Tesler, say hello to the Veterans Radio listeners.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here because your team just reported out a model that may predict soldiers at high risk for perpetrating severe violent crimes and sort of using what's called big data predictive analytics. While that's a mouthful, can you put it into just simple English for us?
Sure. This work you're talking about is part of something called the Army STARS study, which is a big epidemiological neurological study that we've been doing for the last half dozen years under the auspices of the Assistant Undersecretary of the Army with support from NIMH. And it's essentially designed to look at soldier suicide, which, as you know, is a big issue. And as part of the study, we've put together an enormous administrative database for all the soldiers that are on active duty in the Army at any point in time. And, you know, there are over 200 different databases that the Army and DOD keep for active duty soldiers. They obviously the electronic medical record, but there's also all these things about criminal justice data, family and protective services data, data sets on what kind of awards you got, what kind of scores you got on various kind of tests, and of course we have all kinds of information about deployment experiences and characteristics of the deployment, so how many people in your unit were injured, killed, and so forth. So we put that data set together originally to try to just get a description of who were the soldiers that were dying by suicide. And then we discovered that we were able to predict with a useful level of accuracy, and I can go into that in a second, in advance, who were the soldiers who were at the highest risk? And the idea being that although the military gives certain kinds of preventive intervention services to everybody, you know, there are 800 numbers and there are stand downs periodically and there are training programs, to really reach out to soldiers who are in trouble and try to nip things in the bud before somebody goes over the deep end and really hurts themselves seriously. You can't be doing that by following every person around every minute of the day. So the question is, could we find a relatively small number of soldiers that are at high risk on an actuarial kind of basis that would be the sort of people we would reach out to? And so that was our original focus. And when we discovered that we were able to do that, and I can spend some time later, Jim, if you're interested in talking about that, we then were asked about whether the same kind of logic can be used for other purposes. Soldiers have high rates of automobile accidents, for example. And although they don't have high rates of serious violent crime, they have rates pretty much the same as the rest of the population of the same age and sex and education level. There have been these high-profile violent incidents, as you know, in the last few years, and the military is concerned about those. And then we've been doing work on sexual assault, looking at people who are at high risk of victimization and so forth. But in general, this stuff comes under the banner of something that's called, as you mentioned at the beginning, big data analysis, taking these enormous databases that exist in the military and seeing if we could target people who have high risk for various kind of problems so we can reach out, give them help before they do something that's going to change the course of their life in a direction that it's too late for us to give them help.
We're talking to Dr. Ronald Kessler from Harvard Medical School. He's a professor of healthcare policy. And we're talking about work his team has done with the U.S. Army by looking at military records. And I think I saw somewhere, Dr. Kessler, that there were almost 1 million soldiers involved in this data set. And there were probably hundreds of data points for every soldier that you could put into the modeling. And that's kind of what, when we say big data, that's kind of what we're talking about, maybe 1 million with everybody having tens or hundreds of data points.
Yes, that's right. We had about 975,000 soldiers who were on active duty at any time between 2004 and 2009. We're looking at every month of every soldier's active duty career over that time. And we had thousands and thousands of variables. I mean, just the medical variables alone, there are well into the thousands. But when you look at the, we probably had 20 or 30,000 variables we started out with. So it's quite an extraordinary data array.
Now, this particular report, Dr. Kessler, was focused in on that small group of people who commit violent crime. And as you say, it's sort of the same percentage as you see in the general population. But could you define what you mean by violent crime?
Yeah, violent crime, this was serious violent crime, because obviously there's a lot of fist fights and stuff like that whenever you get young men together, particularly ones early in their Army career, and they're getting in line, a chow line, and people are butting in front of each other and stuff like that. But a serious violent crime, these are what the FBI calls major crimes. So it's murder, manslaughter, attempted murder, aggravated arson, so somebody tried to burn down a house to kill somebody, aggravated assault and battery. Now, the most common of those is aggravated assault and battery, and there's a line of, if somebody hits somebody over the head with a baseball bat, is that an attempted murder, or is it an aggravated assault and battery? And it's kind of a judgment call, as you can imagine. They're sort of, hitting people. But that's the lower bound of the line. Aggravated assault and battery and everything more serious than that, that gets counted. That was only physical crimes. We didn't talk about violent crime, property crime. So somebody steals somebody's car, that doesn't count. This is violence. You're trying to hurt somebody.
And excluded from this definition for this particular study included domestic violence and sex crimes.
Yes, that's right.
Those were excluded.
That's right. We're looking at workplace-related kind of things. So when you're in uniform, that happened on the base, we're not looking at domestic violence, and we're also not looking at sexual assault, because there's pretty good evidence that the kinds of variables that predict sexual assault are different in some important ways from the things that predict physical assault. So we are doing separate analyses of those things, too. We're looking at domestic violence. We're also looking at sexual assault. We're looking at predictors of both being a perpetrator and of being a victim. But this particular one that you're talking about was being a perpetrator of a major violent crime.
And did your study, when you crunched all that data, which makes my head spin, could you identify some key predictors in who might be involved in these major violent crimes?
Yes. It so happens when you do these kind of analyses, the problem is not so much to find predictors. And the reason is that when you're looking at thousands and thousands of variables, just by chance, you're going to find a couple hundred that are important, And when you look at so many variables that are redundant with each other, for example, we have information about, being depressed and having alcohol problems and drug problems, but there are all kinds of different measures of alcohol and drug problems. So did you flunk a random drug test, and did you come in for treatment for an alcohol problem, and were you picked up for drunk driving, and so forth and so on. which one of those is the most important variable? A lot of them are correlated highly with each other. It turns out that when you look at all those things, we ended up with well over 200 different variables that were significant predictors of being a violence perpetrator. A lot of those 200 variables were measuring the same thing different kind of ways. So the real trick is to boil them down into a composite. And it's important to boil them down into a composite for another reason, too, and that is that there's no one variable that's a magic bullet. You know, these kind of rare, terrible things, be it committing a murder or committing suicide, they're thankfully very rare things. But what that means is that exactly the right combination of terrible things has to line up to make it happen. It can't just be that you got a bad marriage, or it can't just be that you got a bad temper, or that you are alcoholic or what have you. Because if that was the case, there'd be 100 times more of these things happen than we know there are, because lots of people have bad marriages and lots of people have bad tempers. It has to be, you have to have the bad marriage and the bad temper and the bad time of the day and the bad this and the bad. There's got to be 10 things that line up exactly right to have these things happen. And you can see this in your own experience when you think of the various times in your life that you almost got in a car crash or almost got into a fight or almost something. But there's so many almosts that happen in these rare, terrible things. And the reason is, it's again, it's a fortunate thing, that's why they're so rare, that lots of things have to line up in exactly the right way. So our fancy statistical analysis started out by saying, let's look through the thousands of variables to find the hundreds that are significant predictors, and then use these advanced kind of simulation methods to try to come up with profiles of certain combinations that are rare combinations that might predict these rare outcomes. And when you do that, it's very difficult to say here's the variable that's important or the five variables. It's, you know, you put it into the machine and it's this combination of 50 that lines up in this way, and that's one way of doing it. And there's another combination of 50.
Let me ask you about, with so many variables, I mean, I think probably human nature makes us think that one or two things are the key. Like, does it matter if the troop was deployed to a war theater, or if he stayed in the United States and you know, never fired his weapon in anger? I think human nature says there's a difference there, but maybe your modeling said, no, there really isn't.
Well, there are differences of that sort, but as I said, there's no one particular one. You say, gee, I wonder whether it's only after people deploy. They come back and they've had this experience of violence, and maybe they bring it back and live it out in the civilian world in a way that that they experienced it in a battlefield, and there's some kind of a mismatch there. It is, in fact, the case that after redeploying, the rate of violence, violent crime, is higher than among people who've never deployed. But it's really important not to read too much causally into these, and I'm not going to use a fancy word, into these actuarial predictions. And by that, I mean, actuarial means that we're not saying what causes what here. And there are other kind of things we can do, kind of statistical things to try to get some insights into what causes what, but that's not what this is. It's actuarial just means, can I descriptively say who's at highest risk? And I'll give you a couple of examples of why it's hazardous to make these arguments about causality. We know that people who deploy are considerably healthier than the people who don't deploy. And in fact, in recent research that's been done on suicide, that said, gee, I wonder if deployment is what causes suicide. When you look closely, you discover that the people who never deploy, some subset of them, actually have a higher suicide rate than the people who deploy. As a matter of fact, the people with the highest suicide rate in the military, according to a recent study that was done by another group, over the 9-year period that was studied, and it followed people out of the military too, not just during their their active duty years, but after they separated. The biggest group in terms of risk were the people who only stayed in active duty for 90 days or less. And none of them, of course, deployed because they didn't make it out of basic training. Now, what was causing what there? The most plausible explanation is the kind of people who can't make it out of basic training. They get separated because of having conduct problems or emotional problems or violence problems or crime problems. Those are bad eggs, to use a technical term. And those people, you know, they're the ones, sure enough, if you follow them up over a year, they're gonna have problems. That's not the fault of the Army. And the fact that they didn't deploy doesn't mean that there was something bad about not deploying. It's sort of a selection process. We also know that there's something called the healthy warrior effect. And I don't know if you've ever heard that term, but the idea is that the kind of people who deploy, as you know, that, you know, most units, the whole unit doesn't deploy. There's a rear detachment. And the people who stay in the rear detachment, sometimes they're necessary people who need to stay back and somebody who just broke their arm and couldn't come. But the people with serious emotional problems are the ones that the unit commander is going to say they can't deploy. They're just not eligible to deploy. And so it turns out that the kinds of people who deploy are not a random sample of other people. So it's really tough to say what causes what in those kind of things. So we have a good model that describes who the people are at risk, but it's very tricky to say what do you think caused the fact that they have such high risk.
So and we're talking listeners to Dr. Ron Kessler, professor of health care policy at Harvard Medical School. He obtained his PhD in sociology from New York University and worked for many years at the University of Michigan Institute of Social Research before he moved on to Harvard. And I read that he is one of the most widely cited researchers in the world in the field of psychiatry over the last 10 years, and is a member of the Institute of Medicine, the National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Kessler, since we've got your expertise here, how do we use this algorithm or model that you guys developed? How does society or the military use this kind of information now?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing to think of how it is that these predictive analytic models, as they're called, that are becoming increasingly popular, not just in healthcare, but in the consumer world in particular. You know, how do we advertise to people? What's the new Netflix movie we should recommend to you based on, you know, what we saw you liked before, stuff like that. There are lots of uses for these kind of things that we have, these tools that we can use them. But we're in the early days of trying to think through how to use them. And in some cases, we're able to predict things, but we don't have anything we can do about it. And there's some moral questions and philosophical questions about whether you want to know, for example, genetic testing that can tell us that we have an illness that there's no cure for. Well, these same statistical methods that I'm talking about using here to predict crime are used in those genetic kind of analyses. And there have been several prominent geneticists who said, gee, you know, if a genetic test ever became available to tell me that I have this thing that 20 years from now I'm going to die of it and there's no cure, I really don't want to know, because I think that, you know, I'd rather be happily living along with, you know, what goods are going to do me.
I think many people would take that side of the equation.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And some people say, nope, I want to know. I want to be able to be prepared and so forth. Now, I think everybody, if you said, gee, if I'm going to have an illness and I know I have to take this cod liver oil, which tastes terrible, but I'd do it if I had to stay alive, I'd like to know, you know, in other words, if it has practical implications, you want to do it. So there's that is the first one. The second one is most of the models overpredict. So we can't say precisely who's going to be and a bad thing happen to them, because for many of these rare phenomena, there are some situational factors that we can't measure in the administrative data, that there's kind of the coin flip somehow out there, that maybe one time out of five, this person's going to be the kind of person that will find themselves in a situation that will end up committing a violent crime. But maybe two times out of five, they'll end up being a hero. Now, should we throw all five of those people out of the military? Or should, you know, I mean, there's that kind of thing too. You know, you gotta worry about those sort of issues. And I think the issue that we gotta grapple with is whether we think of this as a glass half full, half empty kind of thing. If we're saying, look, we're going to require people who have a high score to go through some kind of onerous kind of stigmatizing potentially kind of thing that maybe can interfere with their career. You're a potential violent crime committer. They haven't done anything at all. They just have this profile. And to be what's called a high-risk person might still only be one or two times out of 100. It's still a very rare phenomenon, even in the high-risk group. You wouldn't want to do that. On the other hand, if there's something we can do to help people prevent ruining their lives, and maybe ruining the lives of somebody else who they injure, and it's pretty effective, and it doesn't cost an enormous amount of money or doesn't have a lot of side effects, it's not fattening or something like that, then you think, gee, you would like to err on the side of giving that to more people than need it. You know, I mean, if it's no harm, I'd really like to be as broad as possible in helping people out. And so for these predictive analytic solutions, there's always the issue of, is this some help we're providing and we can't afford to provide it to everybody, so we're only going to give it to the high-risk people? And there's some vaccinations like that, you know, only high-risk people can get the vaccinations. Like elderly people get the flu shots when they're limited in some years because they're at the highest risk and they may die. So they, the elderly and infants, they get them first, and then, you know, there's sort of a triage kind of thing. Is that what we're talking about here? We can only afford to do something to help the people at highest risk? Or are we talking about possibly hurting people, stigmatizing them, making them feel bad about themselves, for an uncertain gain? And it's that glass half full, half empty thing that we got to grapple with all the time in these things. And I think in large part, as I've looked at a number of instances like this where these models are built to try to do some good for society, it boils down very often to whether we're talking about something that is a proven technology or a possible technology. And in the case of crime prevention, it's all possibility. We don't have a lot of proven stuff that works. And it also has to do with relative risk. So a good case in point is statin therapy. You know, these are like Lipitor and these drugs sure. for people with high cholesterol. And we've known for many years that particularly middle-aged men that are a little overweight, have high cholesterol, they have a risk of a heart attack and a stroke 2-3 times other people. When their cholesterol gets higher, yeah, that's 5-8 times. And when it gets really high, it might be 10-15 times as high. The idea of hypercholesterolemia and giving people those expensive, originally statin drugs, because of the expense originally, it was only the people who had risks 10 times higher than other people were called having the illness. And the people who were only a mere 2 or 3 times or 4 times or 5 times more likely than other people to have a heart attack, they weren't given the pill. But over the course of time, as the cost of the medication came down, and as we learned more and more about its effects, those rules changed, and now the definition of hypercholesterolemia has been changed dramatically. So there's an awful lot of people, maybe more than doubling the number of people who are now recommended to get it. So the people who have a 2 and 3 times higher risk than other people, they're getting it as well. So
I think that helps everybody understand sort of the risk reward analysis that has to occur and the cost benefit analysis. Dr. Ronald Kessler from the Harvard Medical School, professor of healthcare policy. We really appreciate you talking to us today about the predictive analytical models and solutions that your team's working on for the Department of Defense. It probably raises more questions than it answers, and that's probably the way it's supposed to be. But I know that our listeners on Veterans Radio will be paying attention in the future as more and more work's done in this area. I want to thank you for participating in today's interview. I want to thank all who are listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host on this interesting topic. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or at legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook. Listen to our podcasts and our internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.